Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Technology. I am your host, Jasmine McNeely. So how much do we really think about the technology that we spend so much time using? More specifically, have you ever really considered the possible effects that the use of technology, like your laptop, tablet, cell phone, etc., has on your reading, writing, and overall production of materials? On the show today, we will discuss how these kinds of technologies mediate the different parts of communication with respect to the reader, the author, and the object produced. To help us with our discussion today, we have Lori Emerson, who is an assistant professor of English and the founder and director of the Media Archaeology Lab at the University of Colorado at Butler. She's also author of the new book, Reading Writing Interfaces, From the Digital to the Bookbound. Lori, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real delight to talk with you.
No problem. So perhaps we can start off with, could you give us a little bit of your background, how you came to get into the field and those things?
Sure. My background, I guess it goes back to when I was an undergrad, and I had probably a very cute, naive desire to be a poet. I thought maybe there was such a thing as being a poet full-time. I quickly learned that doesn't exist, went to grad school, and then I just started to be really interested in studying experimental poetry. And for me, that turned into any poetry that had a material dimension to it. So either it was just focused on the sound of letters and words in and of themselves, the look, the shape, the feel, the texture of language, and that led me to digital poetry, which is what I did my PhD on, and just trying to think about whether and how digital poetry is interested in exploring not only sort of the nature of letters and words themselves as little material entities, but also the ways in which we write and how the digital computer affects what and how we write. And then given that interest, that led really nicely into me founding the Media Archaeology Lab, which is basically a collection of still functioning old computers, old hardware, old software, so that people from the public, researchers, students can go in and think about how all these old technologies made possible certain kinds of writing, certain kinds of creation, and also made impossible kinds of creation.
Well, okay, I have two questions for you since you told us that. First of all, what is media archaeology? And the second question is, do any of the computers that are still functioning in the lab, on any of them, can we find Oregon Trail?
Oh, yes, we can. I've got a copy of Oregon Trail on 5 1/4 inch floppy that works on our Apple IIe that's from the early 80s. So
nice.
I think you should come and visit. media archaeology, it's an interesting development in media studies. It came out of the work of Frederick Kittler, who's a German media theorist. And it's interested in looking at, I guess I would say, the material dimensions of technology in and of itself. So less interested in looking at how humans made technology and more interested in looking at how technology actually shapes humans. You could say even kind of makes humans, I guess. So there's that aspect of it. It's also interested in going back and trying to find ways to disrupt the narrative of technological progress that we've all, most of us buy into. And it's really hard not to buy into the idea that everything is getting better and better and faster. And it's all, that's all part of the logic of, you know, having to replace your cell phone every 2 years or 3 years at most. And so going back and looking at earlier developments in computing and thinking about how, in fact, in some ways, computers from the late 70s or the early 80s did some things better than what our computers do now. And it's just, we don't have to think only about speed as being the only criteria for having a better device.
Okay. So reading Writing Interfaces, the book, I was struck that it seems like a combination of both media archaeology and literary studies, because you considered like the poets and experimental writers and how they used this or these older, what we consider older technologies, in ways that we don't really even think about anymore. Mm-hmm. So how did you combine these two fields? Is it a natural combination, do you think?
I actually do, and I find it strange that I'm one of the few people that does these two things at the same time. But I think one of the big things I was trying to get across in the book, and one of my big revelations just personally in the last 5 years or so, has been that you can really think of literary studies as enacting media studies. Mm. You can think of writers as constantly performing studies of media. And I don't know, when you think about literary studies in that way, it just opens the field right up again into all these incredible new possibilities for research and just rethinking the role of literature. I've just been really interested in thinking about how writers and artists in particular have a lot to teach us about the affordances of our technology, because they, more than anyone else, are interested in sort of really pushing the boundaries, the limits of what we think our machines can do, should do, can't do, that sort of thing. I don't know if that answers your question.
Oh, yes, it does, of course. So I'm wondering, like, why... Now, you said you're probably one of the few who consider both of these areas together. I'm wondering why the book now? Why Reading Writing Interfaces, perhaps at this time in history?
That is a good question. You know what? I think it's... So in the book, I talk a lot about invisibility, and that really became my obsession for a number of years, just thinking about how we're told over and over and over again that the more invisible our devices become, the better they are, and that they, you know, the less we notice them, the more effective that they are. And I just realized that's such a dangerous and disturbing ideology, and you can really see it at work in particular with art and literature, as it tries to grapple with how to create on machines that you can't see or machines that you can't get at their underlying workings. Writers trying to grapple with software that's closed, that's proprietary. Mm-hmm. Writers trying to open up their machines and they can't because they've been hermetically sealed to keep people from understanding what's going on underneath the hood. I think that's why the book moves from the present to the past, because you can see actually a long lineage of writers interested in undoing the workings of technology from the present all the way back to even Emily Dickinson in the late 19th century, mm-hmm. thinking about how pen and pencil and paper actually sort of determine what and how we're able to write. Yeah.
Yeah. So perhaps we should back up a little bit, and because we're talking about reading writing interfaces and the use of technology, but perhaps you can explain what are interfaces?
Oh, yeah, that's a tricky question. I guess generally I just think of an interface as anything that mediates between you as the human and the thing that you're trying to write or communicate or produce. So maybe idiosyncratically, I think of the graphical user interface on our computers as an interface. I think of typewriters as an interface, right? It's the machinery that mediates between you and what you're trying to communicate.
Okay, great. Now, another word that you use quite a lot in the book is UbiComp, or ubiquitous computing, which is, I guess, a phrase. But I was wondering if you could explain that as well, because I think that's perhaps important to somewhat the majority of the book.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So chapter one is where I really get all worked up about the idea of invisibility in computing. And I think ubiquitous computing and wearables, that's sort of best embodies the values in computing of trying to make it, trying to make computing invisible. So ubiquitous computing is just the desire to try to make computing devices ubiquitous, to make them everywhere and to make them, in their words, seamless, invisible. They're just embedded in everyday life, and they're often trying to sense information for you. And it's always framed as a matter of convenience that it's doing all these things for you, but the problem is that you can't figure out what it's doing for you, and you can't intervene, and you can't do things for yourself. So that's been my big beef with ubiquitous computing.
Yeah, so I guess a question that arises then is, perhaps, what's the big problem? And perhaps other people may ask this also. So you have a poet or a writer who has a computer, perhaps a very modern computer, or they're forced to get a more modern computer because of, I don't know, consumer pressure or whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're writing, and they get the product using whatever software or whatever that they need. So why consider that even more thoroughly as you're doing in the book? Why, I guess, worry about that would be a question.
I think I started to think about why it's worrisome by talking with some of my colleagues in the electronic literature community. Mm-hmm. And these are authors who have been writing digital literature sometimes since the early 80s, and talking with them about how it's incredible that an entire body of work, or sometimes an entire decade in that mode of writing, is inaccessible to us now because it was created using proprietary software.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the, I call it an ideology, the ideology of planned obsolescence, the way, you know, computer operating systems are constantly being replaced and updated and outmoded. So there's a real problem of access built into the writing at every single level that I think is, well, it's something that we need to be aware of.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how we can really intervene in it too much other than just try to be aware of using maybe open source materials in our own creation. But yeah, that was one of my main concerns. I hope that makes sense.
Oh yes, it definitely does. Now, you point out some names in the book that people may recognize. You talk specifically about Emily Dickinson, who's a very well-known American poet, and also some Canadians like B.P. Nichol and those kinds of people. And what have you found with relation to the interfaces that they use and how it has mediated or did mediate their writings?
Well, I think the chapter on Emily Dickinson is the last chapter in the book, that was actually the first piece of writing that I did that really got me thinking about writers and their relationship to interfaces.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes out of my time spent at Buffalo working with some of the most well-known scholars of Emily Dickinson in the U.S., and one of them was Susan Howe. And Susan Howe is a real firm advocate of us looking at Emily Dickinson's manuscript poems as really the only way to understand what she was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started to look at the manuscript poems, and I realized that Dickinson had this incredible way of adjusting her handwriting, the shape and size of how she wrote, and of course what she wrote, depending on what size of scrap of paper she was working with. Or even what kind of scrap of paper. So just recently a book has come out that collects all of her poems written on the backs of envelopes, and she even has some poems written on telegraph slips, which is really fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell, or I think anyway, that what she wrote has been determined by by that interface of, say, the telegraph slip or the size of the piece of paper. B.B. Nichol, too, I think, I mean, he's a phenomenal poet who wrote in so many different media that I think he, almost more than anyone else, was incredibly attuned to the affordances of different media. And he was actually one of the first people to write a digital kinetic poem on the Apple IIe computer.
Right.
And I started to look at the Apple Basic code and realized that he really was fascinated with experimenting with what the code could do for him, but also what the screen could do for him, and experimenting with how letters could dance around the screen. He has one poem called Off-Screen Romance that just has the words Fred and Ginger after Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, and they just dance. They dance around the screen, and it's really, really simple and charming.
Yeah. So, you know, I hear you talking and reading in the book, and you also mention some Marshall McLuhan, you know, philosophy or theories. And as you talk about how the writers and poets used or were aware of their media, I'm wondering how the McLuhan, or perhaps you could explain to the listeners, the McLuhan, you know, he's always attributed to the media is the message.
Yeah.
I'm, you know, wondering perhaps what your thoughts is with respect to what you've written and you've researched about how these poets and authors have used a different media to express, I mean, obviously the writing, but the media as the expression as well.
Right. Well, I think that, so it's my, gosh darn, what is it, chapter three.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter three, which I talk a lot about Marshall McLuhan and typewriter concrete poetry. That's, I think, a great example of how poets, especially in the late 60s and the 70s, were reading Marshall McLuhan, and even more fascinating, Marshall McLuhan was reading them. And in some of his lesser-known works, he's actually writing about concrete poetry and visual poetry and the way in which it expresses how the medium is the message. Because these poets were not writing lyric poems. They were not describing a scene, or like maybe a beautiful meadow, or they were not describing an internal state of bliss or sadness or something like that. They were actually, I think, writing out the noise or the capabilities of the typewriter. So there's this incredible 10 to 15 year period, especially in Canadian poetry, where poets are using the typewriter in crazy ways and breaking the carriage, playing with the typewriter ribbon, typing over so that you get just typewriter noise, basically, as a way to sort of express the typewriter as a medium in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, for a lot of books, you talk about writers and poets, and we talk about Emily Dickinson and B.P. Nichol again, and perhaps people who are really, I guess, well-known writers, like that's their profession. What about what the computer, typewriter, you know, tablets do with respect to writing and reading for us regular, you know, regular folks? Is there, are there implications for that as well?
Oh, absolutely. So I teach an intro to digital media class almost every single semester, and we always spend some time talking about what difference it makes for you to handwrite a letter, let's say, to your grandma,
mm-hmm.
versus emailing her versus telephoning her. And it's funny. It's obvious to them, like, well, yeah, it's totally different when I write her a letter and I say different things and I express myself differently. But for some reason, our culture tells us to ignore those differences. But then they start to pay attention to it and they start to recognize that how the word processor is something that's so utterly embedded in our everyday lives that we never even think about how it, too, frames how and what we write. in the same way that handwriting does, in the same way that typewriting does. It's just for some reason it's become totally invisible. And so I think the trick is to try to find ways to defamiliarize that most invisible piece of technology. And one person that I have them read every semester is somebody named Matthew Fuller, and he wrote an article on Microsoft Word and the way in which you can do a study of the menu bars, the thousands and thousands of templates and commands, and how there's this overwhelming amount of choice in Microsoft Word, which actually oddly has the effect of taking choice away from you, if that makes sense. It's so much choice that you never actually have the ability to make anything. All you do is choose between predetermined choices, I guess. I think it absolutely affects all of us. It's just that we aren't aware of it, or we don't have the luxury to be aware of it. I think there's something to be said about having the luxury of paying attention to your tools, because I always think about typewriting. The best typewriters are the ones that never think about the interface of the keyboard, right? Your fingers just fly. It becomes invisible, and that's what makes you a really fast, efficient, good typist. If you start thinking about every little, tiny little interaction, then all of a sudden you can't do anything anymore. But nonetheless, I think it's important to give us some thought to add a little bit of friction to the interaction.
Now, you just said something, talking about defamiliarizing themselves, as far as the students, with the technology. I was wondering, like, how would a person go about defamiliarizing themselves with technology so that they are, or become at least a little bit more mindful of what they're actually using or doing?
Yeah. I don't know what the best way is, but I find that actually using the old machines in the Media Archaeology Lab is pretty awesome for accomplishing just that thing. Going back and using totally obsolete hardware, obsolete software, to get a sense of how things could have been and also how things could be. So it's really important to me to try to give people the opportunity to imagine things otherwise, rather than just feeling like they have to passively accept everything that's been passed down to them and everything that's given to them. So going back and looking at, we have this wild computer in the lab called an Altair 8800, and it's from 1975, 1976, and it looks nothing like what we assume a computer should look like. It's a giant box with switches. It's an 8-bit computer, so it has 8 switches. Up is a 1, and down is 0. And for a good number of years, people who use computers actually programmed at the level of 1s and 0s using switches, and the output is these flashing LED lights. So I don't know. I mean, it's fascinating to me to think about how computing could have been if it didn't involve using a keyboard or a mouse or a screen. But it's also fascinating to think about how that process of programming at the level of zeros and ones is exactly what's going on underneath all of our machines. It's just that we don't have access to it, we can't see it, and we don't understand it. I think that return to the past can be extremely useful for defamiliarizing.
Now, if you wanted the audience or anybody really to know one thing or two about your book and about the whole idea of reading writing interfaces as a whole, what would that be?
Oh, that's a good question. I think probably two of my my hobby horses. Two of the things that I get really worked up about is invisibility used as a positive thing in computing, as a positive way to describe how your computer should be, and also user friendly. I get really worked up about this idea of how our computers are user friendly, because I think this is a total fiction. It's an idea of the user friendly according to small group of, designers or programmers in Silicon Valley, and that we're actually all having to adjust ourselves and adjust our bodies and our way of thinking to somebody else's notion of the user-friendly, which actually often isn't particularly user-friendly. Mm-hmm. And that goes along, too, with another word that gets used a lot in that same cluster, which is intuition. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you go back, and God help you if you actually do this, but if you sit down and watch the YouTube videos of all of the iPad launches and the iPhone launches, you'd be amazed at how many times they use the word intuitive. But I always wonder, like, whose sense of intuition is this? Because it's certainly not mine. And the people that it's made for, which sometimes it seems like it might be the people who are in their 50s or their 60s who maybe don't feel comfortable with computers. Apparently, maybe the iPad is supposed to appeal to them, but even they can't figure out how iPads work. So I just find it, I find a user-friendly, invisible, intuition, seamless, all those things, very, very coercive terms. And I think those are some things that I'm working through in my book, by looking at writers and artists and how they're disrupting those ideas.
Mm-hmm. So, Lori, what's next?
My next project I'm calling Other Networks. And it's really, methodologically, it's a continuation of what I did in Reading Writing Interfaces, but this time it's looking at networks. So I'm really interested in how we just refer to the Internet as this homogenous thing that suddenly popped up in the early 90s with the so-called invention of the World Wide Web by Tim Berners-Lee. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in going back and seeing how before the dominance of the World Wide Web, there were thousands and thousands of different networks, all with different affordances, totally different ways of operating, but also had different ways of creating a sense of community. And often creating local communities of users because they were all operating on phone lines and nobody wanted to pay long-distance phone charges, so they were often, communities of local users mm-hmm. Interacting with each other on these funny little networks. So I'm interested in that, and I'm also interested in sort of rewriting the history of the Internet to show that we've got a really weird, lopsided history of the Internet that always goes back to the U.S., when in fact there are so many fascinating, important networks all over the world, in Chile in the early 70s, across Canada, in France, in the U.K. That's the next project.
Great. And so where can they find more from you? Do you have a website? Do you tweet?
I do. I have, yeah. I have the whole shebang. So LoriEmerson.net is where I post a lot of my work. And I'm a pretty avid tweeter, at LoriEmerson, LoriEmerson, and Facebook, too.
Great. Now, they can find the book on Amazon and any place else?
I think pretty much everywhere. You can order it directly from the press as well, University of Minnesota Press.
All right, great. Now, do you have any parting thoughts for...
I can't think of any. I wish I did.
Okay. That's great. But this has been a great discussion and a great thing to think about, reading, writing interfaces from the digital to the bookbound. Thank you, Lori, for coming on the show today. I have been Jasmine McNeely, and that was New Books in Technology. Thank you.